I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. We're in the middle of a chaotic and consequential week in the U.S. Congress. At the top of the list is the worrisome prospect of a government shutdown by the end of this week. Next up, and equally if not more problematic, is the prospect of defaulting on the federal debt if Congress doesn't raise a debt ceiling in the next few weeks. Republicans have said raising the ceiling is the Democrats' problem, even though both parties have played a role in raising the debt to some $28 trillion. Then there's the $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which passed the Senate with the support of 19 Republicans and all the Democrats and is now bogged down in the House. And finally, there's the social safety net and climate package, which would include universal pre-K, an expanded child tax credit, greater access to community college, paid family leave, Medicare expansion to include things like dental, vision, and hearing, green jobs, and more. The price tag is $3.5 trillion over 10 years to be paid for by higher taxes on wealthy people and profitable corporations. So what is Congress going to do? We have two guests who have joined us. Norman Orenstein is emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he has been studying politics and elections and the U.S. Congress for more than four decades, co-author of the book One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Norm Orenstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Molly Reynolds. She's Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. She studies Congress with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedures affect domestic policy outcomes. She wrote a book called Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate. And Molly Reynolds, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. So let me just make sure our listeners can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Norm, let me begin with you with your long perspective. We certainly have had standoffs and showdowns in the past, but this feels more precarious. Are we in a new and different space today?
We are in some ways, Marty, because we have such narrow majorities in both the House and Senate. It's 50-50 in the Senate. The Republicans are uniform in opposing almost everything here, including pretty stunningly the debt ceiling. So Democrats have to get every single one of their members there, and they can afford to lose only three in the House. We have all of these things coming together at the same time. It's kind of a perfect storm. But at the same time, I am relatively bullish on their ability to go right to the brink, but to reach an agreement, with the caveat that, especially in the Senate, you have a couple of people, both Joe Manchin, who's gotten an enormous amount of attention, and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who's getting more and more attention now, that all it takes is one to balk, and they're in big, big trouble. And Manchin, he's a transactional Paul. I think they can cut a deal. With Sinema, it's a little more complicated.
To you, Molly, are you bull? Or it sounds like moderately bullish, like Norm Orenstein.
So I think so. I think it matters a little bit which one of the four things that you're talking about. So I'm confident that by Thursday at midnight, they'll have a deal to keep the government open. I think, pretty confident that ultimately they will find a way to address the debt limit, though the closer we get to the deadline, the more nervous I will get about that. And then the infrastructure bill and the social spending bill, like Norm said, I think ultimately they'll figure out a way to get those done. But it's difficult, and for the reasons that Norm articulated.
Well, let me go back to you, Norm, and actually to quote something that Senator John Tester, he's a senator from Montana, Democrat. He also happens to be a farmer. This is something he told Politico. I have to clean it up a little bit. He says, we always do this blanking dance. I don't know if people are going to put their sane minds on and do what needs to be done or shut it down. This is just a ridiculous exercise. I can't even compare to anything I do on the farm that is this stupid. Do you agree with him, though?
Yeah.
You do. Okay.
Well, it is this stupid. What makes me a little bit nervous is we've seen this kind of ridiculous blank blank before, and we've come back from the brink, especially on the debt ceiling. But keep in mind that in 2011, Mitch McConnell said the debt ceiling is a hostage worth taking. And it's been used before as a way to blackmail Democrats. It was used frequently in the Obama presidency to get something out of it. McConnell pulled it away from the brink. And actually what he did in 2011, we may come back to this, is a one-time what's been called the McConnell rule, where they changed this process. Instead of having to have Congress vote on this, both houses, which wasn't going to happen back then, and McConnell feared that they'd be blamed for it, he said, once the president can raise the debt ceiling, Congress can pass a joint resolution of disapproval, but he can veto that. And that means all he would have to do is hold one third plus one of the two houses. So it became automatic. Now that's not in place. It may get in place before we're done here. But I'm afraid we have a lot of Republicans who are more than willing to let the country go over the cliff. And whether Democrats can find a way out of this, either by getting 10 Republicans to overcome a filibuster, or what's more likely, using this reconciliation process where they only need 50, that's a little more questionable. And, you know, I'm going to put the blame here on a party that is willing to do some things that we would not have even considered in the past.
And that would be what, the Republican Party?
The Republican Party. There's a willingness to either shut down the government or more likely go to the brink and maybe over on the debt ceiling is very unsettling.
Let me quote a tweet from Mitch McConnell. Molly, I'll put this to you. This was earlier this week. He says, let's be clear. With a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate, Democrats have every tool they need to raise the debt ceiling. It is their sole responsibility. Republicans will not facilitate another reckless partisan taxing and spending spree. The debt ceiling has to do with things that we've already, in a sense, paid for, voted on. This is we're just looking to cover the past spending spree that both Republicans and Democrats were a party to.
Right. So McConnell is clearly, for political purposes, trying to link Democrats' efforts to engage in a large amount of new spending, both in the infrastructure bill, which does have some bipartisan support, and the social spending bill. He's trying to link that spending to the issue of the debt limit. But as you point out, the debt limit is really about, and raising the debt limit is really about fulfilling the responsibilities that the federal government has already incurred. It's about paying bills that we already have. So it's not substantively about the kind of new Democratic priorities, despite what the attempts have been to link them.
Molly, what the analogy I've heard is it's kind of like running up your credit card bill, you know, buying all sorts of stuff and then refusing to pay for it. Does that work?
It does. I think that's a reasonable way to describe it. I think the other thing I would say that kind of makes this debt ceiling standoff different than ones previous is that it is not uncommon when we have unified party control, one party in the White House, the House and the Senate, for the minority party to be really reluctant to vote for an increase to the debt limit. We saw that repeatedly in the past decade or so. But what's different now is that Republicans are making it as hard as possible for Democrats to do it themselves.
Because, and this is where we get into some of the arcane, I guess, rules of legislation having to do with reconciliation. Am I getting closer?
Yes, yes. Okay. So Democrats, I should say, Congress has several options procedurally for how it could raise the debt limit. Earlier this week, Democrats brought to the floor in the Senate a measure that would have both kept the government open and addressed the debt limit. That was obstructed by Republicans. Now they have the choice of trying to again do an increase to the debt limit through the regular legislative process, or, as McConnell has been pushing them to do, to use this budget reconciliation process, which can't be filibustered, to do it. The challenge there is that there are a lot of procedural steps that they need to go through to actually accomplish that. It would take, folks think, between 10 and 15 days. And as the days go by, we get closer and closer to the point at which the Treasury Department has said they are out of tools to keep us from default.
Norm, let me go back to you. And that's the date from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. She said we have to figure this out by October 18th. She also said, and this was a piece she had in the Wall Street Journal, we would emerge from this crisis a permanently weaker nation. So why are Republicans playing politics with the kind of good faith of the U.S. government?
You know, I think the answer to that question is a pretty grim one, which is the willingness to incur enormous damage in the country to gain some political advantage, to be able to blame the party in power. And we have a history of knowing that voters don't pay close attention to who's to blame. Frankly, Republicans are helped in this case by most of the press coverage. So much of it, the New York Times has been particularly shocking here, is they look at this debt ceiling issue as a political game where both sides are playing in the game. So there's a willingness to incur this enormous damage. We've seen that, obviously, with COVID. I do want to point out the double hypocrisy of what McConnell said. The first part is we know that the nation incurred almost $8 trillion in additional debt during the 4 years of the Trump presidency. And that's what this debt limit is about. But the second part is when you say the burden is on the majority, they've got the majority in both houses and it's not on us. Let them vote on it. But when that bill came up, as Molly said, they didn't let Democrats have the 50 votes to pass it. They're not going to do it again when there's a clean just raise the debt ceiling. They filibustered it. So they raised the bar to 60, would not provide a single vote. So in effect, they unilaterally blocked the majority from doing what the majority otherwise could do. Every time the debt limit came up during the Trump presidency, Democrats provided enough votes, did not filibuster it, so we could avoid this catastrophe. And it would be, as Janet Yellen said, a permanent catastrophe. Once during the Carter presidency, inadvertently, we breached the debt ceiling for less than a day. But interest rates went up just a tiny bit. But given the volume here, and they stayed that way for a long time, it cost the country hundreds of billions of dollars ultimately. Do it now when the world believes that our political system is broken, and the consequences would be catastrophic.
That's Norm Ornstein, Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, joining us along with Molly Reynolds. She's Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. We are talking about what's happening in Washington, D.C., fights over the debt ceiling, over keeping government open. There's some big legislative packages that are under consideration. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Are we headed for a government shutdown, headed for defaulting on the federal debt? We sure hope not. We're talking about some of the fights in Congress over spending with our guests, Molly Reynolds and Norman Ornstein. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Molly, I want to pick up on something that Norm said, but also throw in a question from Trish. Trish wants to know, how much did the Republican tax cut contribute to the deficit? She said, I read that it added $2 trillion to the deficit in 2018 and 2019. Norm said that $8 trillion was added to the deficit under the 4 years of the Trump administration. How much of that was the tax cuts, and how much for spending on things like the pandemic?
It's a good question. I actually don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I think the question underlines something really important, again, that we've been discussing about the debt limit and why it is so important to increase it and why it really is the responsibility of Democrats and Republicans together. And that is because the spending, both through tax cuts and spending increases over the past several years, that have driven the debt to where it is now. Those were choices made by members of both parties. In the case of the tax cuts, choices made by Republicans only. That bill passed with only Republican votes. And so both parties together are responsible for making sure that the government does not default, that it pays its bills, that it fulfills its responsibilities.
So what can the Democrats, I'm back to you, Molly, what can the Democrats do to push back?
So we are actually seeing this morning from Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Norm was talking before about the possibility that Democrats use the budget reconciliation process to increase the debt limit. That process is time consuming. Again, the closer we get to the deadline, the more challenging it is to get through all of those steps. And so Schumer, you know, is continuing to say that Democrats don't want to do that, that they want to pass an increase to the debt limit through the regular legislative process. And it seems kind of daring Republicans to keep obstructing, to keep getting us closer to default.
Norman, let me read a comment from Mike. He says, I understand that the debt ceiling is about paying off our debts, but isn't it also important to think about the debt that we will be incurring with these big spending bills? We're talking about potentially $1 trillion in infrastructure spending, something like $3.5 trillion in a mix of social service spending and climate spending as well. Is that too much from your perspective?
So keep in mind that the $3.5 trillion number that's been thrown about a lot, and it won't end up at $3.5 trillion, is also over 10 years. And it's basically 1% of our GDP each year in addition. But it's also paid for. Now, how it's going to be paid for in the end, we're not entirely sure. But they're going to have a lot of pay-fors. Let me get back to what Molly was saying the last set of comments. I think the strategy here by Schumer, and this could well backfire on McConnell, is he's going to bring up a clean debt ceiling bill. The Republicans are going to filibuster it again. And that's going to leave just the one option. It's dangerous. It's time consuming, the reconciliation bill. But keep in mind that the problems we've had so far, the problems that the Democrats have had so far with the reconciliation bill, are concentrated around Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And Joe Manchin has said multiple times, let's just slow down. We don't need to deal with this right now. But what's happened is the urgency to deal with reconciliation, to add in something that would keep us from having this catastrophic breach of the debt ceiling, is now ramped up. And so I would guess that when President Biden talked yesterday to Manchin and to Sinema, one of the things he said to them in their private conversation is, look, we're not just dealing with whether we can't get a bill through that will give us all of these programs that we want in our Build Back Better agenda. If we don't get this done, we may end up in a deep recession and a terrible economic catastrophe. So the push to get it done now by Thursday to have at least the guidelines of a bill so that they can begin to move on both of these packages, the bipartisan infrastructure, this larger package, now is ramped up. And if you bring that up for a vote in the Senate, probably a little before October 18th, because as Molly said, it's going to take a couple of weeks to pull it all together. But if you bring it up and there won't be any Republican votes for it, and if, a Kyrsten Sinema decided that she would not provide the 50th vote to make that happen, then it's not just on her that this package of priorities for Democrats goes down. It could be on her that the entire economy collapses.
Whoa.
So it adds to the pressure to get this done.
So
go ahead, Molly.
One thing I'll say is that Among the many reasons why using the reconciliation process to increase the debt limit is not what Democrats would prefer to do procedurally is because there's a lot of uncertainty about, or there's some uncertainty about exactly how it could and would unfold. So Norm has laid out one possibility, which is that they would do one reconciliation bill that contains both an increase to the debt limit and also contains the various social spending provisions that they have been negotiating for passage through the reconciliation process. Another option would be to do an increase to the debt limit through the reconciliation process separately. That has its own kind of procedural challenges. And so, again, what this all comes down to is that we've reached a point where not only are Republicans not willing to vote for an increase to the debt limit, but they are making it as hard as possible for Democrats to do it on their own. Norm talked about how earlier this week Republicans filibustered an increase to the debt limit, that we expect them to do so again on a clean debt limit increase. And so they could simply kind of get out of the way and just let Democrats deliver all the votes that would be needed for passage. But that's not where we are. We're in a world where they are making it as difficult as possible for Democrats to do it on their own.
Let me toss a part of a question from James to you, Molly, picking up on reconciliation. James says, isn't it correct that the Senate can only have one or two or three reconciliation bills a session, just to sort of add to the drama here?
Yeah, so this is a great question from James. And there are limits on the number of times the reconciliation process can be used. They are a little bit complicated, but it's not the I think the important thing to remember about budget reconciliation is that the tool is not unlimited. You get a lot for being able to do things without the threat of a filibuster, clearly. But when you kind of go down that road and decide you're going to pursue legislation without the threat of a filibuster, it comes with all kinds of other rules and restrictions, and the limits on the number of times the process can be used is one of those. I think right now that's not necessarily the constraint that's making things difficult for Democrats. But as we move forward, it's important to keep in mind.
And that's Molly Reynolds, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Also with us, Norm Ornstein, Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. They're down there in D.C., not in the room where it happens, but certainly observing what's going on in the U.S. Congress, fighting over the debt ceiling and keeping the government open in a number of packages of bills as well. Let me toss something to you, Norm. If we didn't have a filibuster, would government function better? Would we be in better shape?
That's not an easy question to answer, Marty. If you completely eliminated the filibuster, there would be some costs to it in terms of the functioning of the Senate. It makes it more like the House. At this point, given the nature of our parties, it would be a better way to go. But I have long advocated for reforming the filibuster as a way of creating a different balance. What's happened in the last few decades, I think inadvertently, given a rules change that occurred in 1975, is that the burden is entirely on the majority. Right. And when you have a minority party that is not interested in bipartisan cooperation, for the most part, you can block an enormous number of important things from happening, things that have enormous public support. It used to be that the burden was on the minority, and they would have to go to great lengths and have some real pain to keep votes from taking place and action from occurring. And there are ways of changing it so that it would be better. Right now, we are in a very bad place with an inability to act on important national priorities, even where there's enormous public support for them. And that means that a rules change is really urgently needed.
And picking up on that and going to you, Molly, you've written about the filibuster. I mean, the idea was, at least on paper, was to bring people together. But it seems like it has had the opposite impact.
Right. So the history of the filibuster is long and complicated. It was not imagined as part of the Constitution. The founders did not create a supermajority requirement in the Senate. The circumstances that made the filibuster possible kind of emerged in the early 19th century, and then changes in the way the Senate operates, the kinds of issues that the Senate was tackling, particularly around kind of sectionalism and slavery in the 19th century, but not exclusively those issues, start to increase the incentive for members to obstruct. And then over the course of the 20th century, we get the filibuster as a more and more routine feature of Senate business. And now the existence of the filibuster in combination with the very polarized parties in the U.S. Senate really does mean that it's very difficult to get to that 60-vote coalition that you need to do many things. And it only, to kind of bring us back to talking about reconciliation for a minute, it only increases the pressure on the reconciliation process to be the way that majority parties in the Senate get things done. If you are a majority party and you can't expect that you will get enough members of the other party to vote with you on some of the things that you want to get done, then your option right now, while the filibuster is still in place, is to try and squeeze your priorities into the confines of the reconciliation process. Mm. And that is hard to do.
And let me read a comment from Casey. Then I do want to talk about a potential shutdown of the government by the end of this week. Casey says, why does no one ever see this for what it is? Does anyone really think elected government would be allowed to default and the consequences that come with it? They'd all lose their next elections. There is nothing more speculating than how sausage is made, and we don't need to see how it's done because it makes less sense than it is worth. I think Casey expressing a lot of frustration. Norm, let me go to you. We've been focusing on the debt ceiling, but there's something a little more imminent, and you both seem to think that we will get to some kind of consensus, I guess, on keeping the government open. But I'm thinking of those government employees who have to prepare for a government shutdown, and we certainly have had government shutdowns. I think the last one was, 2019?
Yes. And, you know, we've had them in the past. Some of them have been just for a few days. The last one was very, very costly for an awful lot of people working for the government. And remember, it's not just those who are government employees who won't get paid for a period of time, but ultimately get back pay, which is very tough if you're operating on a salary week to week. But for contractors to the government, and that's a huge number of people, they don't necessarily get reimbursed for the time that they lose when they're off. You know, we have a lot of people in precarious situations because of COVID over the last 2 years. It would be especially damaging to have a shutdown now. But I'm not ruling out the possibility of that taking place.
Really?
And I think, you know, the last comment that people would lose their jobs at the next election, there are an awful lot of members who, and this is particularly true on the Republican side, who believe that if there's chaos out there, it happens on Biden's watch, it happens with Democrats running the House and Senate, they're in red districts, that it's not going to matter to them. Look at the behavior of people, of governors in states where they're letting their own voters die because of irresponsible behavior when it comes to vaccinations and masks. And they don't think it's going to hurt them politically at all, because culture seems to trump both economic and physical self-interest for people. It's insane, but that's where we are.
Norm, just a quick follow-up, and this is having to do with the government shutdown. If there is a government shutdown, do members of Congress get paid?
Not during the time that the shutdown occurs, although they will be reimbursed ultimately as well. You know, what happens is you don't get paid while the government is shut down, but there's always action afterwards to compensate people for what they lost. And that's true of the congressional staffers who would continue to work even though the shutdown occurred, and all of those deemed essential employees. But it's, you know, it's not a good look, and it's very damaging to large numbers of people.
Molly, and I'll just say,
yeah, go ahead,
just
Molly.
Add that simply the threat of a shutdown, so the fact that we are having this conversation, 36-ish hours before the funding would run out, like, having repeated threatened shutdowns is itself costly to federal operations. So because there might be a shutdown tomorrow at midnight, federal agencies have to prepare for that possibility, have to figure out which of their operations would be considered essential or accepted and keep going, which ones would not be. They have to lay out procedures for folks who would be furloughed, tell them kind of what to do in the event of a shutdown. And all of that planning, even if ultimately before midnight tomorrow we get a deal, like that's time that folks spend that they're not spending serving the American taxpayer.
I hear you. I know you have to leave us in a minute or so, Norman Ornstein, but in the next, let's say, 36 hours, what do you see Pelosi doing? What do you see Schumer doing?
Well, I think what we're going to see, especially with Pelosi and Schumer, is they're going to spend most of their time trying to reach this reconciliation deal on the larger human infrastructure package, because we have a vote scheduled for Thursday or tomorrow. And Pelosi doesn't want to do it unless she's sure she has the votes. For Schumer, it's going to be bringing up both a clean, keep the government running until December, and a clean debt ceiling increase, watching the Republicans filibuster both of those, and then trying to figure out what the next step is. And they're going to keep pushing this, I think, till the very latest point before they have to turn, as they do, to reconciliation to resolve these issues.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, Norman Ornstein. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Norman Ornstein, Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He has to leave us. Staying with us, though, for the rest of the hour, Molly Reynolds. She's Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. And we have spent 40 minutes talking about the debt ceiling and keeping the government open. I do want to talk about infrastructure and also social spending programs and the trillions of dollars that are potentially in the pipeline. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and I've been talking with Molly Reynolds about the debt ceiling and also keeping the government open by funding the government. Essentially, the deadline for that is tomorrow night at midnight. I do want to talk about some of these spending packages, including $1 trillion of spending on infrastructure and potentially $1.5 trillion on social safety net programs, including things like child care and elder care, community college, green jobs. And we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Molly, going to the infrastructure plan, I guess this is called, or bill, this had bipartisan support in the Senate. What is it doing in the House? What's the holdup?
Sure. So you're absolutely right that back in August, the infrastructure bill passed the Senate, and then it went over to the House, where a group of more progressive House members have said that they don't want to take action on the infrastructure bill until the reconciliation bill, the social spending bill, the one that has the various health provisions, child care provisions, that sort of thing, until that's finished. But that bill is not finished, as we were talking about earlier. And so we're at a little bit of an impasse. There are two groups of Democrats in the House, one of them wants to vote on the infrastructure bill this week, and the other one does not.
And why this debate over which bill goes first, or whether to do them separately or together? Why do progressives want this reconciliation bill? This is the bigger price tag bill. Why do they want that to go first?
They are concerned that if the social spending bill does not go first, some of the moderate Democrats who are nervous about the overall price tag of the bill or in various ways don't like some of the individual provisions that are being talked about as possibly being included in the bill. We saw a week or two ago some debate among House Democrats over some prescription drug pricing provisions, for example. But the progressives are concerned that if the House does not take action on the bigger reconciliation bill first, those moderate members who want to see the infrastructure bill passed will ultimately not vote for the reconciliation bill unless they have the infrastructure bill passed second.
My head is exploding. I don't know.
Mine too. Sometimes.
How do you keep up with this stuff, Molly?
It's hard. If it's hard for you and me, it's really hard for anyone who doesn't pay attention to this stuff for a living. And it's also important to remember that we are, in the case of both the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill, talking about spending and programs that are really important to Americans, both now and in the future.
Well, here are a couple of component parts. Part of this reconciliation bill, this is the larger bill that includes programs related to housing and education, child care. We're talking about a child tax credit. I assume that's pretty popular. We're talking about child care costs, helping to defray some of those costs. For seniors, talking about dental, vision, and hearing, talking about cheaper drugs, as you mentioned, talking about free or reduced community college, paid leave, expanded preschool. I'm assuming if you took all these out and tried to figure out what the public reaction was, there would be overwhelming support for all of this.
Yeah, so there is many parts of the reconciliation bill are really popular with the American public. And the question is, how do you sort of put them together in a way that both gets support from the majority, the 218 Democrats that you need in the House and all 50 votes in the Senate? And how do you put them together in a way that meets these complicated, arcane rules of the reconciliation process that lets Democrats do this without the threat of a filibuster?
And is it popular, the idea of taxing, frankly, wealthy people and profitable corporations? Is that a popular item?
It is a popular item. I will say that there are specific tax provisions that are under debate here that matter more or less to people who live in certain parts of the country. So I'm sure that from WHYY we are reaching some folks in New Jersey where provisions related to the state and local tax deduction that were changed in the 2017 tax law, there's some debate over whether they will be addressed in this package. So there are, and this is part of why the process of getting to yes is so complicated with such narrow majorities in the House and the Senate. Many individual House members, many individual senators have things that are important to them and their constituents, and trying to get all of those pieces to fit together is a real challenge.
And we're talking, you know, potentially $3.5 trillion. I mean, compared to other big packages that have made their way through Congress, is this gigantic?
Yeah, so that $3.5 trillion number is a little tricky. That is the sort of the potential gross cost of the bill. Some of it will be paid for. You know, we are talking about the potential for tax increases. We were talking about about the prescription drug pricing provisions, which if they are included, will bring in some revenue as well. It is a quite large piece of legislation. And one of the things that is true about it in a way that we haven't seen in more than a decade is just how many policy issues it really touches.
Yeah.
So when we think about other recent big legislative achievements like the ACA, the Republican tax cut bill, or even Republicans' failed attempt to repeal the ACA in 2017, they were about one specific thing. It was the healthcare bill, the tax bill. This is, and you can see this in sort of our kind of struggle of what words to use to describe it, it has so many different parts.
I mean, it feels a little bit like the kitchen sink, not in a bad way, but just there's a lot of stuff in here.
Right. And that's, again, one of the consequences of having very narrow majorities and very polarized parties in the Senate, where Democrats do not think that they could write a bill that would get Republican support for things that are very important to their agenda. They are forced to go through the reconciliation process and really put all of these things together in one package in order to try and get it done.
It's funny because I was trying to figure out, are we talking about the Build Back Better bill? Are we talking about the social spending and climate bill, the reconciliation bill?
It's all of those things.
Is that part of the problem? We don't know what to call it.
It's certainly a challenge for Democrats who want to try and build public support for the bill. We haven't sort of settled on one piece of language to describe it. I'm sure the White House would like it if everyone was calling it the Build Back Better bill.
Sure.
But it really does have a, and you mentioned the climate piece, that both between the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the climate provisions that are under consideration for the reconciliation package, that there's a lot of potential, a lot of important things that could get done, and we just don't quite have the language to encompass everything that's in the package.
Oh, goodness. Let me ask you something about this infrastructure spending that was passed by the U.S. Senate, bipartisan passed. We're talking about human infrastructure, correct? And the kind of built infrastructure, the roads and bridges?
Yeah, so the infrastructure bill that the Senate passed that is now over in the House is more what we would consider kind of traditional infrastructure. So roads and bridges, it does have some climate-related provisions in it, but it's much when we sort of spent the Trump administration talking about, is it Infrastructure Week? That was those sorts of projects that we were talking about then are the kinds of things that are in that infrastructure bill. The more human infrastructure pieces are what are under debate for the reconciliation package.
Got it. Here's a comment from Jonathan. He says, I am so frustrated watching what's happening in this country and all the fighting between Democrats and Republicans. I came from Africa 21 years ago, and it's very sad watching all the politics, the negativity, and politicians working against the good of the country.
So I think Jonathan's sentiment here is shared by many Americans. We actually have good polling data that suggests that Americans really don't like to watch the messy process in Congress, but also that they want Congress to, particularly folks who voted for now Democrats who have the majority, or Republicans when they had the majority, their voters want them to do the things that they said they would do if they sent them to Washington. And those two things can kind of be in tension, wanting the parties to actually govern and actually accomplish what they're trying to do, and also accepting that can be a really messy and sometimes ugly process.
Are there members of Congress who, I know there's the problem solver caucus in the House. I mean, are there members of Congress who represent the two parties or various ideologies that can and do come together to try to figure some of this stuff out?
So you mentioned the Problem Solvers Caucus. There's another group of House members who have, it's called the Select Committee on Modernization, who have been working really hard to sort of restore certain collaborative norms to the House and just make the House a better, more functional operation. And so there are certainly members who are really trying to do that work, to make Congress work better. The real challenge, again, is that in an era of very polarized parties, and it is difficult to get to a policy priority that you can get bipartisan support for. And you have to ask yourself what value does bipartisanship have? Inherent value. Bipartisanship is valuable to the extent that kind of people have greater amounts of trust in the system if they see it as bipartisan. But at the end of the day, you know, if voters sent Democrats to Washington with promises to do things, like, they want to see the party that they voted for deliver on those things. And again, the same is true when Republicans have unified party control. And that, again, is just a challenge.
But do you think it's a more toxic environment today? Or, I mean, we've always had parties that and people that disagreed with each other on policy.
I absolutely think on sort of an interpersonal level, there are a lot more interpersonal challenges in Congress for members than maybe there used to be. I think that this was true before the insurrection on January 6th. I think it is especially true after January 6th that members of Congress are really grappling with what does it mean to work with folks who, you know, at the very least some of them who voted for throwing out the electoral votes from several states. And that just, I think, has presented what was already a challenging environment on Capitol Hill with even more challenges.
Do Republicans or does the Republican Party, I mean, do they have their policy proposals or are they more there to essentially block the Democrats?
So now that Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the presidency, Republicans really are in a very obstructive posture. It really is about trying, in many cases, to stop what Democrats want to do. But even if we look back at 2017 and 2018, during the 2 years when Republicans themselves enjoyed majority party control of the House, the Senate, and also control of the White House, they did not have an especially robust legislative agenda. They wanted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They tried and they failed. They wanted to cut taxes. They were successful at that. And then in the Senate, a huge priority for Republicans was confirming federal judges, which they were quite successful at in those 2 years. And that was really the extent of their legislative agenda. And it represents a pretty fundamental difference between the two parties in the current moment. Democrats generally are much more about an active federal government, wanting government to do things for people. And Republicans have a much narrower view of what government should be doing.
So what do you think Nancy Pelosi will be doing this week besides not getting any sleep?
Making a lot of phone calls deputizing other members to make a lot of phone calls, talking to Chuck Schumer, talking to Joe Biden, and just trying to figure out a way to get out of or to thread this very, very narrow needle that they currently find themselves in.
I mean, is she an arm twister? Is she someone who threatens people? Does she use those grandmother skills to get people
She uses all of the above. She's a very gifted legislative leader. We have lots of people like to say never underestimate Nancy Pelosi. You're absolutely right that she does like to use her mother of five voice sometimes to get.
It's kind of scary too.
I can imagine to get folks in line. But I think she'll be trying to use all of the tools at her disposal to figure out what the right move is and how to get out of this particular box.
And do you think that, I mean, the first deadline is keeping the government open. Do you think by then 11:59 tomorrow night we will have some kind of resolution?
I do think that we will find a way to avoid a government shutdown tomorrow night. The kind of thing to remember about government shutdowns is that someone has to want them. There has to be a group of members who think that they have a good reason to kind of go over that cliff and shut down the government. And no one really wants one right now. It's just a matter of getting agreement through the House and Senate to keep the government open. And so I think that I'm pretty confident that by tomorrow at midnight we'll have done that.
Well, I appreciate you walking through this very complicated process. Molly Reynolds, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book called Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.